Watchman's Teaching Letter, Volume 3, Norse Legends, Watchman's Teaching Letter Number 45, January 2002, from the 2002 Watchman's Teaching Letters by Clifton Emmeheiser, read by Dan Adams. This is my 45th monthly teaching letter and continues my fourth year of publication. As I'm preparing this letter, there are some topics I would like to bring to your attention. 1. First of all, for those of you who are helping in support of this ministry, I would like to give you an idea what that assistance is being used for. In my last mailing for December 2001, when I sent out 2 Watchman's teaching letters, plus 9 brochures weighing 3 ounces total each, the postage alone came to about $318. Toner for the copy machine came to $182.84, paper $64.20, envelopes $4.20, making a total of about $569.24 in all. Inasmuch as a good portion of my readers are prisoners, you are in effect helping to give meat, give drink, clothe, visit the sick, and imprison the very Savior himself. Matthew 25:35-40. For I was an hungered, and you gave me meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, and fed thee, or thirsty, and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger, and took thee in, or naked, and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick, or in prison, and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me. 2. I got an interesting letter from a supporter telling me he had purchased a Strong's Exhaustive Concordance with the Greek and Hebrew dictionaries, and informing me he had looked up the Hebrew word number 398, akal, and that it didn't indicate anything sexual about Eve's seduction by Satan, where she said, Genesis 3:13, the serpent beguiled me and I did eat. I promptly made him a copy of what the Gesenius Hebrew Chaldee lexicon to the Old Testament had to say for the word number 398, akal. Of the 4 main meanings, number 3 says this: to enjoy anything, as good fortune, Job 21:25, the fruit of good or evil, sexual pleasures, Proverbs 30:20, compare Proverbs 9:17 and 5:20, end quote. I would highly recommend that every anti-seed liner who scoffs at Eve's sexual encounter with the serpent invest in a Gesenius lexicon, as all of them who use just Strong's use the argument that akal can only mean to eat. Notice how Gesenius uses the phrase the fruit of good or evil. Does that remind you of a certain tree? 3. I have now written 15 special notices to all who deny to seed line, of which I have distributed only 10 to date. Through this, I have come to the realization that the subject of the two seeds of Genesis 3:15 is even more serious than I formerly adjudged. Let me explain it this way. There are certain basic tenets to our quote-unquote Christian faith. These beliefs are as follows. We believe that Yahweh created all things visible and invisible, that he became flesh and dwelt among us, that he was of one substance being both man and Yahweh, that he suffered and died at the hands of unrighteous men, that he rose again, Matthew 12:40, 27:63, Mark 8:31, that he ascended into heaven, that from thence he will return to judge both the living and the dead. Every one of these tenets are essential and indispensable. Anyone who denies that Yahweh came in the flesh is an antichrist. See 1 John 4:3. To deny there were two seeds of Genesis 3:15 is equally as wicked, for if there was no seed of the serpent to bruise the heel of Messiah, betrayal and crucifixion, we have no redemption. If he was not bruised for our iniquities, we have nothing to look forward to except the grave. It is blasphemous, therefore, to even infer he was not bruised. It is every bit as sacrilegious to imply that he was not bruised as it is to say that the Word was not made flesh. Yet that is what the anti-seedliners insist on doing. In short, theirs is an antichrist religion. Their shameful position is nearly identical to Gnosticism. We insert here that we know very well what Gnosticism was and is and has always been a fake, both philosophically and based on who its adherents have always been. Continuing, if there is no seed of the serpent, there is no bruising. If there is no bruising, there is no redemption. Thus I will repeat again, the anti-seedliners, or whatever you wish to call them, are teaching, wittingly or unwittingly, an anti-anointed one, anti-Christ, anti-Messiah doctrine by denying two-seedline. Some advocate that we two-seedliners should declare a truce with the anti-seedliners for the good of the Anglo-Israel message. To that I respond, should we also make a truce with those who declare Yahweh did not come in the flesh? I will deal with this in greater detail in future special notices. Insert. At this time, mid-2014, Clifton has written 24 special notices to all who deny two seed line, which, Yahweh willing, will be read as a supplement volume. False Odinism. As I promised in the last lesson, we are now going to consider original, true Odinism, as opposed to the present corrupted false Odinism. I should warn you again, there are a lot of half-truths and downright lies on the subject of Odinism on the internet. Much of it is coming from Australia. From the website angelfire.com, there was an article posted entitled Odinism versus Nazism, dated October 28, 2001. I would state unequivocally that I am opposed to any form of socialism, including Nazism. But what this website is promoting in the name of Odinism is absolutely not in line with true Odinism. It is quite apparent from some of the remarks of the writer that it is written with the object of being politically correct, according to today's standard for that term. I hardly believe the Vikings knew anything about political correctness. If anything, the Vikings would have to be considered very politically incorrect. Here are some excerpts from that article. I write this because the name Odinism in the USA has been defiled due to the actions of some people who commit terrorism and racism and have become monitored by some hate group monitors. The Nazi racial teachings center around racial purity and preservation and are against miscegenation or so-called interracial marriage or procreation, forgetting that all of us are supposed to belong to the human race. She, Lady Griselda, states, mainstream Norse pagans, Asatruar, believe racism is wrong and point out that arguments the gods and goddesses want purity of race are off base since the gods and goddesses themselves mated with other races. The races most often referred to in Norse lore are the Æsir and the Vanir, two races of gods, the Jotuns, also known as giants. There is much mating between Æsir and Vanir, and there are several Æsir or Vanir and Jotun marriages. One point that is often brought up is that after Ragnarok, when the new gods start again with the new Midgarth, several of these new gods will be children of the god Jotun unions, including Thor's sons, Magni and Modi. Lord Odin has also mated with gods of other tribes or races, if ye prefer. Then the Nazi teachings against miscegenation and so-called racial purity is completely incompatible not only with our lore, but with Odinism. What about Loki? Loki is a pure Jotun, giant of ice, who was not only accepted by the Aesir, but he became the blood brother of the Allfather, Valfather, Siglord Odin. Also, Skaoi is still a Jotun, but she was accepted by the Aesir without any problems. What does the Allfather teach by this? He teaches that a person's acceptance must be judged by his or her own conduct of behavior and personal values. Then there are those who perpetuate racial activities such as the several hate crimes that occur on a daily basis, those who deny the genocidal horrors of the Holocaust during World War II, those who destroy and deface places of worship and other property, commit murders and assaults based solely upon racial, ethnic, and sexual orientation differences, those who demote women to the status of breeding machines in order to sire a pure white race, those who advocate racial segregation and teach their children to hate those who are different in a bastardized and failed Nazi vision of Germanic religion. Such people don't deserve the name Odinism. Actually appears that way in this very poorly written piece. Of course he meant Odinism. Our Viking forebears were not racists or racialists. Race was not an issue to them, only culture. The Norsemen practiced so-called interracial marriages, as it happened with the Inuit Eskimo people is a good example. Well, if it happens, would the new husband or wife and the half-breed children be Inuit or heathen? Answer: it depends upon how the new husband, wife, and or his or her children would act. If they acted as in the Norsemen values and culture, they would be accepted in the Norse community. And the Norsemen had many interracial marriages. We and they must respect the freedom of others against Asa folks or kindreds that do not adopt these characteristics. Rather, they accept people regardless of gender, race, or sexual orientation. Evil or dishonorable folks can be found everywhere, irregardless of ethnic origin. The Odinism is a religion of balance. A true Odinist recognizes that every aspect of nature, ethnic and cultural, is needed to make humankind ritual as it is. Prosecution against people or ideas just because they are ethnically, culturally different or think in a different way don't deserve the name or label Odinist. End quote. I hardly believe I need to explain where such garbage as this might be coming from. If it is not coming from a quote-unquote Jew, it certainly is from someone who is brainwashed by them. No thinking person could believe that the lifestyle of the Norse could be so portrayed. Yet some uninformed swallow this refuse hook, line, and sinker. Our people are being attacked by the enemy from every conceivable angle. As a matter of fact, the lifestyle of our people was just the opposite to this. To show you a true picture of the high moral fabric of our ancestors and what they were really like, I will now quote from St. Paul in Britain by R.W. Morgan, pages 42 and 43. In clan times, however, the preservation of the pedigree meant the preservation of all that was valuable in blood, station, and property. Without it, a man was an outlaw. He had no clan, consequently no legal rights or status. Genealogies were guarded, therefore, with extreme jealousy and recorded with painful exactitude by herald bards of each clan. On the public reception, at the age of 15, of a child into the clan, His family genealogy was proclaimed, and all challengers of it commanded to come forward. Pedigree and inheritance indeed were so identified in the ancient British code that an heir even in the ninth descent could redeem at a jury valuation any portion of an hereditary estate from which necessity had compelled his forefathers to part. End quote. From this, it is conspicuously evident that these false Odinists don't know what they are talking about. Get that, people? Want to follow big mouth talkers who know nothing except how to package and sell some more garbage of the mind that sounds cool, etc.? Better come back down to earth and stop wasting yourself on such caca. Not only that, but scripture informs us we need to observe our genealogy back to at least the 10th generation, Deuteronomy 23:2. Once there has been a race mixture established, every few generations there will be a throwback to that admixture. Once the DNA has been polluted, there is no recourse of correction to that racial contamination. It is the unforgivable sin. Therefore, the utmost caution must be observed to avoid miscegenation. Checking the records back at least 10 generations is substantial evidence there was always purity of race. You'll notice in the quotation above the British required 9 generations, or does it mean to the 10th? If so, the British were going by the law of Yahweh on racial matters. While some may have forgotten many things from their former past before their captivity and their 7 times punishment, Leviticus 26:18, they remembered well the importance of their racial purity. Problematical Odinism. Now that we have done some investigation of false Odinism, let's consider some problematical Odinism. For this, I will quote from a book entitled The Story of Norway by Halmar H. Boyesen. This is an old book published in 1886. While some of what we are about to read may be true, there are other elements we should question. Much of the Norse mythology here is based on Snorri Sturluson's writings. Besides the Heimskringla, Snorri also wrote the Younger or Prose Edda. I believe we will find greater truth in the Elder Edda. See if you can detect what some of these problems might be ahead of time, for we will cover them and compare them to Elder Edda in greater detail in lesson number 46. Now quoting from this book, Chapter 2, entitled The Religion of the Norsemen, pages 13 through 24. The Icelander Snorri Sturluson wrote in the 13th century a very remarkable book called the Heimskringla, or The Sagas of the Kings of Norway. In this book, Snorri says that Odin, the highest god of the Norsemen, was the chief who first led the Germanic tribes into Europe. He was a great warrior and was always victorious. Therefore, when he was dead, the people made sacrifices to him and prayed to him for victory. They did not believe, however, that he was actually dead, but that he had returned to his old home in Asia, whence he still watched their fortunes and occasionally visited them in person. Many tales are told in the sagas of people who had seen Odin, particularly when a great battle was to be fought. He was represented as a tall, bearded man with one eye, and clad as a warrior. He had 2 brothers, Vile and Ve, and many sons and daughters who were worshipped like him, and became gods and goddesses. Odin and his children were called Æsir, which Snorri says means Asia men, and their home Asgard, or Asaheim, likewise indicates their Asiatic origin. During their migrations, the Æsir came in contact with another people, called the Vanir, with whom, after an indecisive battle, they formed an alliance. The Vanir then made common cause with the Æsir and were worshipped like them. Whether there is any basis of truth in this tradition is difficult to determine. We know that primitive nations usually make gods of their very early kings and chieftains and worship them after death. Every year that passes makes them look greater and more mysterious. In storms and earthquakes, in thunder and lightning, They hear the voices and see the manifestations of their power. More and more they become identified with the elements, which they are supposed to rule. The mighty attributes of the sun, the sky, and the sea are given to them, and each is allotted his particular sphere of action. The chieftain, who has been a valiant warrior in his lifetime, is supposed to give victory to those who call upon him. He who has excelled in the art of peace continues to rule over the seasons, and to give good crops and prosperity to those who, by sacrifices, secure his goodwill. This may have been the origin of the Scandinavian gods, although many scholars maintain that they were from the beginning personifications of the elements, and have never had any actual existence on Earth. But whether they were originally men or sub-myths, interesting legends have been told about them, which may be worth recounting. In the beginning of time, there were two worlds, Muspelheim, the world of fire, whose king was Surtur, and Niflheim, the world of frost and darkness. In Niflheim was the spring Hvergelmir, where dwelt the terrible dragon Nidhoggr. Between these two worlds was the yawning chasm Ginnungagap. The spring Hvergelmir sent forth 12 icy rivers, which were called the Ilevagr. These gradually filled up the chasm Ginnungagap. As the wild waters rushed into the abyss, they froze and were again thawed by the sparks that were blown from the fiery Muspelheim. The frozen vapors fell as hoarfrost, and the heat imparted life to them. They took shape and fashioned themselves into the Jotun, or giant Ymir, from whom descends the evil race of frost giants. Simultaneously with Ymir, the cow Audhumbla came into being. She licked the briny hoarfrost, and a mighty being appeared with the shape of a man. He was large and beautiful and was named Bura. His son was Bur, who married the daughter of a Jotun and got 3 sons, Odin, Vele, and Ve. These 3 brothers slew the Jotun Ymir, and in his blood all the race of Jotuns was drowned, except one couple, from which a new race of giants descended. Then Odin and his brothers dragged the huge body of Ymir into the middle of Ginnungagap and fashioned from it the world. Out of the flesh they made the earth, the bones became stones and lofty mountains, and his blood the sea. From his hair they made the trees, and from his skull the great vault of the sky. His brains they scattered in the air, where its fragments yet float about in queer, fantastic shapes, and are called clouds. The flying sparks from Muspelheim they gathered up and fashioned them into sun, moon, and stars, which they flung up against the blue vault of the sky. Then they arranged land and water so that the ocean flowed round about the entire earth, and beyond the watery waste they fixed the abode of the Jotuns. This cold and barren realm beyond the sea is therefore called Utgard, or Jotunheim. From the earth to the sky they suspended a bridge of many colors, which they named Bifrost, or the rainbow. The Jotun woman Night married Delling, the Dawn, and became the mother of Day, who rode in his shining chariot across the sky, always followed by his dark mother. The latter drove a huge black horse named Hrimfaxe, from whose foamy bit dropped the dew that refreshed the grass during the hours of darkness, while Day's horse, Skinfaxe, spread from his radiant mane the glorious light over the earth. It is further told that the heat bred in Ymir's body a multitude of maggots, which assumed the shapes of tiny men and were called gnomes or dwarves. They live in caves and mountains, and know of all the treasures of gold and silver and precious stones in the secret chambers of the rocks. They also have great skill in the working of metals, but they cannot endure the light of the sun. Last of all, man was created. One day when the 3 gods, Odin, Hörner, and Lodur, were walking on the shores of the sea, they found two trees, and from these they made a man and a woman, named Osk and Embla, Ash and Elm. Odin gave them the breath of life, Hörner speech and reason, Lodur blood and fair complexions. The old Norsemen conceived of the world as an enormous ash tree named Yggdrasil, the three roots of which extend one to the gods in Asgard, another to Jotunheim, the third to Niflheim. On the third gnaws continually the dragon Nidhoggr. In the top of the tree sits an eagle. Among the branches four stags are running, and up and down on the trunk frisks a squirrel who carries slander and endeavors to make mischief between the eagle and the dragon. Under the root, which stretches to Jotunheim, is the fountain of the wise Jotun Mimir, to whom Odin gave one of his eyes in return for a draught from his fountain, for whoever drank from its water became instantly wise. Under the second root of the ash, which draws its nourishment from heaven, is the sacred fountain of Urd, whither the gods ride daily over the bridge Bifrost. Here they meet the three Norns, Urd, Verdande, and Skuld, past, present, and future, the august goddesses of fate, whose decrees not even the gods are able to change. The Norns pour the water of the fountain over Yggdrasil's root, and thereby keep the world tree alive. They govern the fates of gods and men, giving life or death to whomever they please. Odin dwells with all the other gods in Asgard, where he receives in his shining hall, Valhalla, all those who have died by the sword. He is therefore called Valfada, All-Father, and those fallen warriors whom he chooses to be his guest are known as Sinheriar, that is, great champions. Valhalla is splendidly decorated with burnished weapons. The ceiling is made of spears, the roof is covered with shining shields, and the walls are adorned with armor and coats of mail. Hence the champions issue forth every day and fight great battles, killing and maiming each other. But every night they wake up whole and unscathed and return to Odin's hall, where they spend the night in merry carousing. The maidens of Odin, the Valkyries, who before every battle select those who are to be slain, wait upon the warriors, fill their great horns with mead, and give them the flesh of swine to eat. The great gathering place of the gods in Asgard is the plains of Ida. Here is Odin's throne, where he sits looking out over the whole world. At his side sit the two wolves, Gera and Frekke, and on his shoulders the ravens, Hugin and Munin, who daily fly forth and bear him tidings from the remotest regions of the earth. If he wishes to travel, he mounts his eight-footed horse, Sleipnir, which carries him far and wide with wonderful speed. When the father of gods and men rides to battle, he wears a helmet of gold and a suit of mail, which shines dazzlingly from afar. He carries also his spear, Gungnir, which he sends forth whenever he wishes to arouse men to warfare and strife. But besides being the god of war, Odin also delights in poetry and sage counsel. He is the god of skalds, or poets, for he had drunk of Suttung's mead, which imparted the gift of song. He is well skilled in sorcery, and has taught men the art of writing runes. Thor, the son of Odin, lives in Thrudvang. He is the strongest of all the gods, and has an enormous hammer, Mjolnir, which he carries on a ceaseless warfare against the Jotuns, or mist giants. He rides in a cart drawn by two rams across the Gjallar Bridge, the resounding bridge, which leads to Jotunheim. And the rattling of the cart and the noise of his hammer as he hurls it at the heads of the fleeing giants make the vault of the sky tremble. This is what men call thunder. When Thor is hungry, he kills his rams and eats their flesh. but he is always careful to gather up the bones and to throw them back into the skins. Then, the next morning, the rams are as frisky as ever and ready for service. Thor has a wife named Sif, whose hair is of gold. Balder, the good and the beautiful, is also the son of Odin. He is wise and gentle, and kindness beams from his countenance. His wife is Nanna, and his dwelling Breidablik. Njord is ruler of the sea, and can raise storms and calm the waves at his pleasure. He is of the race of the Vanir, but is yet worshipped as a god. He is the owner of great wealth, and can give prosperity to those who obtain his favor. Njord was married to the Jotun woman Skade, but was again separated from her. His abode is at Noatun, from which he has wide view of the sea. Frey, the son of Njord, rules over the seasons and gives peace and good crops. Fields and pastures grow, and the cattle thrive in the sunshine of his favor. He lives with his wife, Gerd, in Alfheim. Tyr is the god of courage, whose men call upon as they are about to go into battle. He has but one hand, having thrust the other into the mouth of the Fenris wolf, who bit it off. Brage is the god of song and of vows and pledges. He has a long beard and is possessed of wisdom and eloquence. When men drained the horn in his honor, they made vows of daring deeds that they would perform, and called the god to witness that they would keep them. Many were those who, while drunk, pledged themselves to foolhardy undertakings and perished in the attempt to carry them out. Braga's wife is the ever-young Idun. She has in her keeping the wonderful apples, which the gods eat to preserve the beauty and vigor of an eternal youth. The watchman of the gods is named Heimdall. His senses are so keen that nothing can escape him. He can see hundreds of miles, and he can hear the grass grow. When he blows his Gjallar horn, the resounding horn, its rousing call is heard throughout the world. Heimdall's dwelling is Himinjarg at the Bifrost Bridge. Among gods of less consequence may be mentioned Ullr, the stepson of Thor, who is a master in running or snowshoes. Forsetta, the son of Balder, who makes peace between those who have quarreled. Hurdur, the blind god, who shot Balder. And the silent Vidar. Foremost among the goddesses is Frigg, the wife of Odin, who dwells in Fensal. She shields from danger those who call upon her. Freya, the northern Venus, is the goddess of beauty. She is the daughter of Njord, and was forsaken by her husband Odd, yes, spelled that way too, and she is ever hoping for his return. Typical. She traveled far and wide in search of him, and wept because she could not find him. Her tears turned into gold, and gold is therefore by the poets called the tears of Freya. Her chariot, in which she drives over the sky, is drawn by cats, though at times she flies in the guise of a swan and visits distant lands. Her necklace, Brising, made by wonder-working gnomes, is of dazzling splendor. The dwelling of Freya is Folkvang, and thither ascend the prayers of lovelorn swains and maidens. Freya's daughter, Hanos, is of marvelous beauty and a sweet disposition. Her name is still used in the nursery as a pet name for babes. The domain of the sea does not belong entirely to Njord. The Jotun Aegir rules over the towering waves and lashes them into fury until Njord again curbs them and bids them be still. Yet Aegir is the friend of the gods and is at times visited by them in his magnificent submarine hall, where ale and mead flow abundantly, He is himself peaceably disposed toward men, but is overruled by his terrible wife, Ran, who, with her 9 daughters, the waves, cause shipwrecks and draws the drowned men down to her watery abode, a feminine Davy Jones locker. One dweller in Asgard is still to be mentioned, and that is the evil Loki, who disturbs the peace of the gods and will work their final ruin. He was born among the Jotuns, but gained the confidence of Odin by his agreeable presence and his fair speech. He delighted in mischief and loved evil doing. He had 3 terrible children, the wolf Fenris, the world serpent, and Hel, with 1 L. As these monsters grew up, the gods foresaw that their presence in Asgard would cause trouble. The wolf Fenris was therefore, after having broken the strongest chains, tied with the magical cord made of the noise of cat's paws, women's beard, roots of mountains, and other equally intangible things. This cord he could not break. The world serpent was thrown into the ocean, where it continued to grow until it encircled all the earth and at last bit its own tail. Hel, with 1 L, was banished to Helheim, where she became the ruler of the dead and the goddess of the underworld, an ultimate feminine satanic ruler of hell. End quote. Now let's consider various things we have just read, some of which we will postpone and cover in our next lesson. Let's start with where it speaks of Odin giving one of his eyes at the Fountain of the Wise, Jotun Miner, in exchange for a drink of wisdom. Does this mean that Odin actually literally had one of his eyes removed in order to gain wisdom? Or does it mean that Odin became single-minded in his purpose? We are told this by our Redeemer in Matthew 6:22 and 23. The light of the body is the eye. If therefore thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. But if thine eye be evil, thy whole body shall be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in thee be darkness, how great is that darkness? In Matthew 5:29, our Messiah also instructed us concerning our eye this way. And if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into Gehenna. Evidently the Almighty, according to Norse mythology, was also known to them by the name of Odin, for in their version of creation of man it speaks as follows. Last of all, man was created. One day when the 3 gods, Odin, Hörner, and Lodur, were walking on the shores of the sea, they found 2 trees, and from these they made a man and a woman, named Ask and Embla, Ash and Elm. Odin gave them the breath of life, Hörner speech and reason, Lodur blood and fair complexions. The important elements here are blood and, of course, fair complexions. Here it's a royal bloodline and a people only with a white complexion. You can see from this that the Norse were very heedful of the importance of their race. Also, the Norse knew 2 seed line and who their perpetual enemy was, as recorded at the end of chapter 2. One dweller in Asgard is still to be mentioned, and that is the evil Loki, who disturbs a piece of the gods and will work their final ruin. He was born among the Jotuns, but gained the confidence of Odin by his agreeable presence and his fair speech. He delighted in mischief and loved evil-doing. He had 3 terrible children, the wolf Fenris, the world serpent, and Hel. As these monsters grew up, the gods foresaw that their presence in Asgard would cause trouble. The wolf Fenris was therefore, after having broken the strongest chains, tied with a magical cord made of the noise of cat's paws, women's beard, roots of mountains, and other equally intangible things. This cord he could not break. The world serpent was thrown into the ocean, where it continued to grow until it encircled all the earth and at last bit its own tail. In chapter 1, page 1 of this same book, The Story of Norway, we read the following. Who were the Norsemen? The Norsemen are a Germanic race and belong accordingly to the great Aryan family. Their next of kin are the Swedes and Danes. Their original home was Asia, and probably that part of Asia which the ancients called Bactria, near the sources of the rivers Oxus and Jocartus, present-day Kazakhstan. Not only the Norsemen are supposed to have come from this region, but the ancestors of all the Aryan nations which now inhabit the greater portion of the civilized world. Among the first to leave this cradle of nations were the tribes which settled upon the eastern islands and peninsulas of the Mediterranean under the name of Hellenes, developed long before the Christian era, an art and a literature which are in some respects yet unrivaled. The early Italic tribes, from which sprang in time the world empire of Rome, trace their descent from the same ancestry, as do the Celts, who in ancient times inhabited England, Ireland, and France. End quote. Fortified with this information, we should now be better prepared to recognize original true Odinism as opposed to current corrupted false Odinism. We will attempt to find much more plausible truth on this matter in the next lesson. End of Watchman's Teaching Letter number 45. Thank you for listening.